morning. I'd like to welcome everyone this morning to our special PEO Leadership Live webcast with Professor Rosabeth Moss-Cantor. For those of you joining us for the first time, a special welcome to you. It's during these times that it's extremely important for all organizations to step up and help each other. At PEO Leadership, we've been working hard to support our members during this time. Our essence hasn't changed. It's actually amplified. The essence is really we're here to help our leaders succeed in realizing both their personal and professional objectives. And usually, actually almost in 100% of cases, it revolves really around their organizations. But we do look at five sort of verticals. One is business, health, wealth, family, and for some of you, your careers as well. And the way we approach it is through a three-legged stool. So the first leg in terms of helping us sort of achieve what we're offering is by, the first leg is really our executive advisors, who are some fabulous leaders who have led in the past. Some have led some of the big multinational organizations. Others have been with the McKinsey's and the Bain's, who dedicate their time with our leaders, developing a roadmap of what success looks like and sort of accompanying them along the journey. The second leg of the stool, which many of you participate in, at least if you're part of PEO, is those advisory boards, which typically we had met once a month. We sat around a table, we closed the door, we challenge each other, and we really address some of the issues and opportunities that we're each faced with and look to each other and leverage the wisdom around the table to sort of move us in a direction of moving toward, sort of getting us from A to B. And the third piece, which you're all sort of participating with us today, is sort of the community. So with over 100 leaders participating at PEO Leadership, the ability to sort of step out of those groups and be able to leverage the wisdom of the whole community is huge. And it's not just about getting from A to B, it then becomes, how do I accelerate you from A to B? I mean, that's a little bit about PEO Leadership. And I think what we've learned over the last 6 weeks, when everything has changed, moving from monthly meetings to we're doing weekly Zoom meetings with everyone, is the support has been absolutely, I mean, that's probably the most important thing here. Our attendance numbers are way up. We rarely have a member that misses a meeting. And like I said, now they meet on a weekly basis versus a monthly basis. And I think that speaks a lot to the importance of community and the importance of support during this time. All right. On this live webcast, we have Professor Rosabeth Moss-Cantor. Professor holds the Ernest L. Arbuckle Professorship at Harvard Business School, specializing in strategy, innovation, and leadership for change. Her strategic and practical insights guide leaders worldwide that include major corporations, governments, and startup ventures. The former chief editor of Harvard Business Review, Professor Cantor has been repeatedly named to lists such as the 50 most powerful women in the world, Times of London, and the 50 most influential business thinkers in the world, Thinkers 50, and in November 2019 received their biannual Lifetime Achievement Award. She's received 24 honorary doctoral degrees, as well as numerous leadership awards, lifetime achievement awards, and prizes. Author or co-author of 20 award-winning books, her latest book is Think Outside the Building, How Advanced Leaders Can Change the World One Smart Innovation at a Time. I'm very excited to welcome Professor Cantor with us today.
Thank you,
Professor. Now, as we get moving along here, we're going to do this as a fireside chat here. But from a logistical perspective, if you can use the group chat to sort of put out your questions, Kelly and Joanna are going to help me out and sort of going through those questions as they arrive. And we'll go out to you in the audience to sort of pose a question directly to the professor. So, Professor Cantor, let me start with the book, Thinking Outside of the Building, which is, I have to tell you, the first book that I actually couldn't read because Amazon isn't even functioning properly. They told me I get the book in 45 days. So I actually had to listen to the book on Audibles, which was an experience, but was actually a great experience. How do you think, you know, you wrote that book and over last year, you talk, I think, in the first chapter about pandemics. The reality is there is a pandemic now. How do you think it relates to today's environment?
Thank you all Thank you all for watching. I can't see all your faces, but I do see Tim's wonderful beach scene. So thank you, Tim, for a little bit of what the outside world actually could look like. So I wrote Think Outside the Building to say that leaders have to think about more than just their own company, but even for their own company to survive and prosper, they have to think much more broadly. We get innovation because we look far outside our current structures, our current operations. And so I start out by saying, there are a number of problems in the world, and if we don't do something about those problems, that even for those who have comfortable businesses rolling along as normal, if we don't address some of those problems, there will be trouble. And among the problems I listed are things particularly plaguing the United States. Some of them also plague Canada and other countries. But on my list of economic and environmental issues were pandemics. And people said, oh, you were so patient, you thought ahead. Actually, we've seen it. There have been others, not to this scale. So I was simply looking at the things we don't normally look at and say, we need innovative thinking to tackle those problems. Some of them are actually business opportunities. In fact, just to give you one ray of hope, I have a former student who's a serial entrepreneur in Silicon Valley who already is working on a venture that could easily take temperatures through a little screening machine like a metal detector. So it wouldn't be cumbersome. You just walk through it. And he's already working with some airlines and airports about piloting it. So ingenuity sometimes comes from thinking outside the building. I mean it in other ways too, though. I mean that we need to pay attention to our communities and to all of our stakeholders, as I know Len and PEO are doing, because they are those for whom we ultimately work. So my book is full of the stories of people who are not waiting for somebody in the national government to say, do it. They're just doing it. So the other relevance of my book is that we all need to take responsibility without waiting for somebody to ask. In fact, in my home country, as you all know, there are many people stepping up with compassion and brilliance and doing things at the state and local level and creating new ventures and working on platforms to help neighbors help each other and so forth. And there's only really one major figure I can think of who hasn't been much of a leader in that crisis. So we can't wait for people at that level, at least in America, to tell us what to do. So my book is about how we need a new army of democracy. We need an army of change agents. We all need to think about how we not only build our businesses, we bring innovation through our businesses. We bring innovation to the world so that we can solve some of these difficult problems. Now, right now, we're trying to just get by. I mean, these are really tragic times. If I sound optimistic, it's because I'm a natural optimist and because I believe in the power of people. I believe that while we are trying to help healthcare workers, for example, who needed stockpiles of supplies that were not there, what we all should be doing now is stockpiling ideas, is using our imagination to start thinking about how we do even better for all the people we're responsible to when we recover from this, as we certainly will. I don't know the time frame. I do know, having looked at many turnarounds, small and large, many disasters, small and large, the financial crisis, volcanic ash in Europe, Ebola outbreaks, I know that it's human imagination and ingenuity, and its leadership that get us through it.
Thanks, Rosabeth. It's funny. I believe in optimism too. I mean, humans throughout history have been extremely resilient. We'll pull through this. Absolutely. And even in our community, I'm starting to see leaders, you know, working on that PPE, getting the, redoing their manufacturing facilities, right? Producing those garments, producing the masks. It's amazing how some of these leaders and their organizations and their people have really transitioned through this. I want to break this into three areas, and I've been thinking about this. One is the crisis that we're in today, a transition period, because I think there's going to be a transition period, probably longer than most of us imagine. And then this new world, which will apply to some people, or we can call it a reset. It may not be applicable to all organizations. In the article, there was an HBR article, you talked a little bit about the crisis and some of the leadership behaviors. Maybe you can talk a little bit, what are some of the critical things as a leader in managing through a crisis that you believe are absolutely necessary?
Thank you, Lynn.
And this is before the transition.
Yeah, thank you. I don't mean to talk over you. Thank you for that question, because in fact, I'm working on something now talking about the three time frames in which we have to operate simultaneously. And one is just the short term. The short term, it's the tone leader set. So it's abundant and open communication, frequent communication, even to the people that are no longer maybe directly working for our companies. The more we say what we stand for and we share the facts and we share what we know, that's really important. Those companies that never recover from a downturn are the ones where leaders are in denial, leaders go home, pull down the shades, as I say in my book, go into closed inner circles, make decisions in secret, and never want to say they're uncertain and they're scared too. So you set the tone at the top. Secondly, you take care of all of your people. You make sure you know where they are, how they're doing, and where you can, you help them get whatever aid is available. You might start joining your people in neighborhoods. I remember there was a time when IBM had a big downturn and morale was very low. And also at that point, it happened that 40% of their workforce was working remotely, which happened to contribute to low morale. And one thing they did was they created neighborhoods by postal code, and they appointed a mayor, quote unquote, for each neighborhood to check in on people and to think about what they could do together, whether it was virtual concerts or providing everybody with help. So you build new kinds of connections in a pandemic. So in the short term, I think that's the most leaders can do. We're all reeling, we're all scrambling to figure out how we manage, what remote work means, how to talk on Zoom. And a little fun at that time, a little uplift. I start my Zoom classes now with either a cartoon or a beautiful virtual concert. There's one you should also look, you all should look at. Just Google Love Sweet Love, Berklee College of Music. It's very uplifting. And so that's what leaders do. They take care of their people short term. You also want to talk, I know, about medium term and longer term, because we also have to make a lot of decisions. I mean, one other thing you do want to do in the short term is you want to immediately tighten belts, review expenses, and think about priorities. What is really important? There's a lot of things that are discretionary, and now's the time before it really hurts to stop bleeding cash if you can.
No, that's great, Rosa. It's funny, like we've been doing this for 6 weeks since really, I'm trying to think, it was middle of March when everything really started to hit us home here. And we spent a lot of time with our leaders saying, absolutely, it's all about your people now. And then you also had all the governments coming in with all the different changes, subsidies, and then it was all about cash flow. So today though, what I'm trying to push them to think about is a little bit more in this transition phase. I'm sitting here going 6 weeks, we've moved a little bit. How do we start thinking about strategy? And especially today, because most of these individuals know how to do strategy, but it's ambiguity. Like there's so many unknowns. So how do you deal with strategy when you got all these unknowns out there? Yeah. And you got to come up with some type of clear vision or some type of mission that you actually got to, because you're going to have to engage your people, right?
Right. So I divide that, and by the way, I love having a conversation. I know that I sometimes sound like I'm lecturing, but that's kind of in the, you know, that's what I do. So in the medium term, where we are entering now, and I want to divide that off from the long term, because let's not forget imagining a world beyond. We need that. We need to feel there's a world beyond, and we also have to be getting ready with our ideas for that. But in the medium term, you go into fix-it mode. You go into what are the weaknesses in our business up to this point, and what can we do now to put teams to work thinking through how we fix it. Operations are the focus. I said leadership tone at the top in the beginning. Then you have to go into operational mode. You have to think about logistics. You have to think about how you get things from place to place. You have to think about how your suppliers are doing and whether there's anything you can help with your suppliers. Are there new local suppliers? Are there new partnerships that could help you find new suppliers? Now is the time to find out where there are suppliers who are close to you that might be ready to work with you. That was another thing when I was working heavily with IBM. And I'm going to use lots of other examples too, but it happened. We created something in the great financial crisis called Supplier Connection that would help small companies get contracts with big companies almost right away on the web. So for those of you who have digital capabilities, what are you doing about platforms and new connections and new partnerships? But this is definitely fix it in operational mode. And also in this mode, there may be employees who think that there were things that were weaknesses before that they want to fix. And you might have been doing really well before, but in fact, employees always have ideas. And one way you put people to work, even if they can't come to work, and even if they're furloughed or part-time or remote, is you ask for their ideas. You get them involved. Their ingenuity in fixing things can be wonderful. I am about to write about an example of an electric car company in China, in Wuhan, China, that was one of the first to open and also one of the first to close. And they closed early because they listened to their people who said, you know, this is a lot worse than the government's telling us. They closed early. They paid their suppliers in advance so that their suppliers would still be with them. And they started innovating like crazy. And one of the things they did was they did a sort of digital test drive a car so that people could go to a dealer and go to unlock a car. And they could test drive it without any contact with anybody. So I'm impressed by that. I mean, trusting your people is not simply caring about them, it's also listening to them. So get those fix-it teams to work and get people in breakout rooms on Zoom sharing ideas about what will operationally get us through this so that we're ready to not only go back to business, reopen, but do it stronger with some of the things that we might have worried about before. Less worries. And that's different from, I know, Len, you might want to say something about the longer term, because it won't be a normal world after. I hope it's a better world, actually.
Yeah, no, it's, I agree. Those are fantastic ideas. The one thing, Roosevelt, I push back on is thinking about, they do need to understand a little bit, like as a leader, it's always been, we've always thought about leadership as around, you got two jobs. One is you got to envision what the future is going to look like, right? You're planning way in advance. And number two is you got to be there and inspire and engage your teams and build that culture. My worry is on the reset, you almost have to have a sense of where the possibilities are on the reset to be able to guide your teams beyond the operational side, even a little bit.
Also, I totally agree with that. And I was hoping that the tone said in the beginning at the top helps us with that. Of course, when you focus on what's really important, that comes from your purpose and values. I'm a total believer. The whole theme of Think Outside the Building is you get leaders with a sense of purpose. The purpose is larger than themselves. They're not simply defending themselves, their past behavior, and wanting to go back to pretending nothing ever changes. They're people who for whom the sense of purpose is so strong that when they do, for example, change production, so they're making face masks, or they're making ventilators instead of auto parts, or they are doing, I have one new venture that is doing, it's a matching platform for volunteers with causes. Well, they are offering a free match called Mutual Aid, and they scramble to do that. That's because of their sense of purpose. So why are we here? We're here to make a better world. And sometimes when you have that, you also can pivot a little. That is, you can say, now, some of the ways we were showing our purpose may not be relevant. If our purpose is to get food to people, I know of restaurant owners who quickly said, we want to get food to people. Do we care whether they're sitting down at tables? Well, you know, they're the servers we care about, but no, we want to get food to people. And that was the larger purpose. That's incredibly important. That sustains you and that sustains people. I must say, though, that you have to have credibility doing that. So you have to show yourself that you value it. You have to do the single. One of the classes I taught last week to my MBA students on Zoom, a little challenging, was about Nelson Mandela, because he led a turnaround in South Africa. And one of the ways he was credible and inspired people was by his actions. He reached out to people that were former enemies, and he did that visibly. He took actions that showed people he cared about them. I think there's a Walmart commercial that had me almost in tears, because Walmart has been trying hard to fix some of the problems of America, like gun violence, even though they come from a state that has a lot of guns. Well, the CEO of Walmart is shown walking through a warehouse, talking, and then through a store, talking about how valuable our people are. He was there physically and personally, and of course, that means a little risk. And that was inspiring.
Yeah, I totally agree. Your credibility, the actions. One of my advisors talked about today, empathy, actually, combining with purpose and being able to express it. She actually said, you know, and it's funny, there was, I don't know what the article was, but she talked about more about women being stronger at that and really rising during this crisis compared to men, because they actually knew how to express themselves and knew how to carry empathy on it.
So naturally, I would love that as a long-term advocate for women's leadership, and that women are just as good and can play big roles in the workplaces. But of course, I mean inclusion. I'm not saying women at the expense of anybody else. However, of course, those characteristics of caring for people and empathy, that's some of the things we learn as parents. Not just moms, but parents, but also, you know, some of the leaders, the CEOs that I've worked with closely, who are often the most empathetic and can read people the best and show compassion the best, are also men. So I believe everybody can do it, and we should not try to foist that off on women. Say, okay, you're HR, so, or you're communication, so you're our empathetic person, so you're the one to talk. Now is the time, and I hope that leaders will talk from their heart once in a while, sharing a little personal story. I know we're always concerned about that. I'm an incredibly private person. People, I'll get notes from students around the world who say, I'm writing a paper on you, but I Googled you and I can't get any personal information. And I say, yes, it worked. I really don't want to be too personally revealing. On the other hand, talking about how, you know, I'm suffering too. I have family members. I have a very sick student in France right now. He managed to get back home from Boston. That helps with the empathy side. And I agree with you, by the way, Lynn, about that emphasis on the human side of leadership. That's it. That's what we have now. The money will return or not, and governments are working hard on bailout stimulus. God knows that long list of problems I say that need to be solved. Some of them are things governments should be investing in now, like infrastructure and transportation. That seems a no-brainer. In our crowded cities and our remote rural areas, we should have broadband everywhere. I also, by the way, have students who are not able to have a firm internet connection to go on to Zoom classes because they went home to places that don't have enough broadband. And I'm thinking, this is North America, not the third world. And we should be working on those problems too. So those, I think, will get resolved, but it's people and human empathy. But it's also, Len, thinking about those bigger problems. That gets me to the longer term, but it also gets me to what leaders do. As you said, leaders communicate and inspire and have a sense of purpose in the short term, but they also see what the world needs, not just try to predict what the world will do. They're ahead of the curve on what the world needs. And we know right now that the world needs more attention to public health, more investment in public health. The world needs more partnerships and collaboration. The world needs something Canada is now doing, by the way, because in the book I talk about some leaders who have a new matching service for skilled refugees with employers in other parts of the world who need them, skilled refugees from the Syrian crisis. And Canada has actually been a very big supporter of that. And naturally, my country, not yet. So there are ways that, for example, a manufacturer in Ontario now has a pipeline of skilled workers when millennials wanted to work in Toronto instead. Maybe rural areas will seem more valuable. But we have to fix a lot of problems. Homelessness, boy, do we see what a big problem that is. And it's not just a problem for the people who are homeless. It creates vulnerabilities for all of us. They suck up the resources. They put everybody at risk. And so who but business leaders need to be thinking ahead? And then, like my imaginative Silicon Valley serial entrepreneur student who immediately said, you know, we need technology to take temperatures easily. Like we have metal detectors, there must be ideas in your own business where you can be incredibly creative and innovative. And I think now you put a team on it. You put a team saying part of your job is just brainstorm about future possibilities. One more thing is the new normal will not be a new normal like that we all have to worry about hugging people. I hope that someday, maybe it'll be 18 months. We're going to have a lot of hugs in there, building up for our family. But it's not just about being able to do things we did before. It's also about fixing the problems that have gotten in our way. And seeing that those problems are not just owned by some people. Those problems are something we should all pay attention to, because the most vulnerable among us need to be served, or they will make us vulnerable too. And longer term, what are the innovations? What are the new technologies? What are the new ways of doing things? Now everybody's remote and digital. What does that suggest about the workplace of the future? How do we make sure that enough kids can be educated online at least part of the time? You know, there may be things that your companies do. You may have staff right now who are specialists in IT, for example, who might want to contribute to brainstorming about that future.
Thanks, Rosabeth. That's really helpful. You know, you talk about advanced leadership, and I know that's the course that you've sort of put in place at Harvard. And when I was reading about your 7 traps of advanced leadership, some of what you've been talking about, the leadership, some of them really pertain to this time in terms of getting our heads around it and understanding, not knowing it all, engaging our people, not knowing what the future holds too, but brainstorming with our teams. Can you talk a little bit about how do you take some of our leaders and make them great leaders in a short period of time as advanced leaders?
Yeah, right. So I use the word advanced partly that, a little play on words, because advanced leaders, I started about thinking about people with experience, and then I thought, no, it's really people who take on, think about these bigger problems outside the company. They may be a good accountant in the company. They may be able to become the chief financial officer. They may be great at HR, but now they have to think a little bit bigger about how those skills apply outside. And that can be hard, because many people spend their careers in silos, in bubble wrap, where they're talking to people who think exactly the way they think and tell them what they want to hear. And sometimes they don't even venture out to think about the community. And, you know, we all go to work and often dressed the same, although we're not all dressed the same at the moment, but I'm dressed up. I always dress up on Zoom. But we don't know what kinds of lives people live at home. We are all incredibly different at home in our home lives. And so getting outside of this narrow way of thinking that we're all alike and talking to only people who disagree and expecting the hierarchy to work for you, there's always somebody to help you. Getting out of that mindset, because that's not how you solve community problems. That's not even how you innovate. You need new partners. New partners, especially potential customers, may tell you things that you don't necessarily want to hear. And being able to be open to new experiences, I think, is incredibly important. Right now, many of us are confined to our homes, so our new experiences are through the internet. But boy, aren't we lucky that we at least have technology now that connects us and that teaches us new things? I can't imagine what it was like in earlier eras when people were really isolated. So we have opportunities too that others haven't had.
No, that's very true. Thanks, Rosabeth. Kelly, can we open it up? I'd like to open it up to questions to everyone in the room here. So I'm going to pull on Kelly here to maybe pull the question and have you, she'll unmute you and you can ask the question. So Kelly, can I pass the mic to you?
Absolutely. We have William Ratcliffe that wants to ask a question.
Hi, William.
Hi. Do you feel embarrassed about the U.S. today? When I grew up after the Second World War, I thought of America as rational, pragmatic, compassionate, and it seems to have disappeared.
Oh, William. I'm so with you, but I don't think it's totally disappeared. And actually, my message in Think Outside the Building and my message to you is that compassion and caring may not be the federal government, but it certainly is there, state and local, an incredible amount of compassion and caring. And yes, I'm a little embarrassed. I certainly am not there to defend somebody that I have worked to defeat. I'm certainly not there at all, but I think the governors have been heroic and they have been wise. They have consulted people. They have worked in some cases well with mayors. The mayors have been heroic. So our government has been terrific, but also our communities, our innovators. So one of the things that I write about is when Alexis de Tocqueville, the French aristocrat, came to America in the middle of the 19th century to see what democracy was all about. He wrote Democracy in America, and he never mentioned the federal government. He mentioned community action. He mentioned community organizing. He mentioned associations. And that's always my source of hope. That's the countervailing power. And otherwise, you're so right. And it is getting tremendously embarrassing when I travel around the world. Luckily, I'm not traveling now, although I'm supposed to be talking to an audience in South Korea, which has handled this pretty well. Yes, it is embarrassing, but it's not the whole story. I mean, it's risky, it's dangerous, but it's not the whole story. I don't give up on America because I see the rest of America.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, thank you for your comments.
Where are you, William, right now?
I'm in Waterloo, Ontario, the home of the ever-shrinking BlackBerry.
I know that as one of I still use my BlackBerry. I'm one of the few, but I haven't given up on it yet, although I have an iPad. I use lots of devices. Thank you for BlackBerry and Waterloo.
Thank you.
Thanks, William, for the question. You know, it's interesting. Rosabeth, I heard a YouTube with Yuval Harari, who's a really huge thought leader of mine that I really admire. But he did talk about the one thing we are missing is leadership in the U.S., because it's usually been the U.S. that has led everything for the world. And especially when we got such a global crisis going on, that void has really hurt.
Well, yeah, global crisis, global leadership, an absence of actually global leadership, getting countries together, comparing notes. I mean, what a time to take the awful step of saying we're not going to fund the WHO. What else do we have? We can decide to try to improve it, change it, but we need it. We need these kinds of partnerships. And, you know, this is a time, I do know that there are many Americans who have said, this is a time to want to be Canadian.
We love being Canadian.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. I've done a lot of work in Canada. I love it too. You know, we have our border closed. But yes, we need global leadership. I know for everything that I say about we've got local leadership, we have advanced leaders willing to step up, found causes, solve the refugee crisis, do something imaginative about homelessness, help small businesses get back on their feet. We've got a lot of that leadership. And in fact, I'm impressed at how much there is, because that's all, because as I said, that's the American spirit. But without global leadership at the top, the White House, so we do have an election, at least we have an election.
No, that's great. We still love the American, and we love, Canadians love Americans. So, and we know you guys will come through this.
You know, I was in Egypt visiting on business a few years ago at a time when there was a lot of anti-American sentiment. And I was on business, but we did a little tour and there were checkpoints. And the driver said, okay, when they stop you at the checkpoint, tell them you're Canadian.
Oh, that's great. Kelly, do we have a couple? I think you have a couple more questions there in the queue.
Yes, we have Allison. Go ahead, Allison.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Rosabeth. This is really fantastic. I have a question. How would you recommend that leaders best leverage their boards of directors or advisory boards right now?
Great question, Allison. Allison, where are you talking from?
I'm in Oakville, Ontario, just outside of Toronto.
Uh-huh. Hello.
Hello.
Boards, you're right, because you have assets. Boards have assets. Not only do they have wisdom, but they also have assets. And on boards that I'm on, we're being asked, what can we contribute? Sometimes those assets are support for the frontline workers. We have access to certain resources. I think that one of the things that we need to do during this crisis is to find out how we assemble and mobilize as many assets as possible. So having board conversations about what are you doing? What do you know others are doing? But also, what assets do you have that will bring a smile to the face of the people who are still working very hard or the people who are out of work? What do you know? I know some big companies that are trying to get together to create a job matching service as they need fewer people in one area. Maybe others will need them. So boards can be a tremendous source. And then this idea of smile on your face. What if you have a board member who knows people in the entertainment business and who could mobilize a special virtual entertainment or concert just for your people. That would put a smile. I mean, we can't do things in person and physically, but there's an awful lot of things that boards are in position to contribute besides looking at the balance sheet.
Terrific. Thank you.
Elizabeth, that brings up, you know, when you had capabilities connecting and cash and courage, of course, but the connections of those board members as an asset is huge, right? Not just the brain power, but as you mentioned, their connections, the way they think and being able to leverage that.
Absolutely.
Kelly, you've got another question?
Yes, we have a question from Tim. Please go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, thanks very much, Rosabeth, for being here. And I will say we have a lot of clients that are Americans and we love dealing with them. So I'll start with that.
Tim, where are you and what beach is that?
That is in Costa Rica.
Uh-huh. But you're not in Costa Rica now.
I wish, but no, I'm in Toronto.
Okay.
My question is, if you have any suggestions for us as leaders, how we can build collaborative virtual teams?
We have to start trusting the people. We have to start with opinion leaders, thought leaders, people who are respected by each person who that you want on the team, and go to your partners where you have connections and ask them for the same and get those people sharing experiences and talking to one another. I think it's harder online. On the other hand, it's more important now and people understand it and people can be trusted to figure out things themselves. And if you start with the opinion leaders and people who are positive, we don't want the whiners. We want them to go home and get over it somehow. We want people who are likely to lead in a positive direction, but we have to trust the people. We've got to get them to do it. And if you let teams self-organize, that's one reason I like one of the functions on Zoom. We can have these very large virtual meetings, but we can go into breakout rooms and have small groups get to know each other and figure out whether they want to connect after that. It also helps to give people direction, as you know. Just to say, be a team and figure it out doesn't work. You've got to give people either options or a sense of direction and then ask them to report back. You got to give them deadlines. People work better with deadlines. And I'm finding that these moments of remote work, deadlines and routines seem to mean a lot to people. And those, I think, would be the few things that can start getting those teams together and have them report back to you, the leader, and to the other leaders. Right now, also, by the way, everybody's on Zoom overload. There are so many things that your customers want you to sign up for. There are so many events. But I think stating the importance of this, and so I guess I'd add a fourth thing, is some sense of acknowledgement or reward after a team has delivered their ideas or a product or a plan.
Great. Enjoy
Costa Rica.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim, for the
question. Or dreams of Costa Rica.
Yeah. Beautiful place.
Kelly, you have another question for us?
Yes, we have a question from Nick Ralph. Nick, go ahead.
Thanks, Kelly. Hi, Rosabeth. Thank you for your time today. Just had a quick question for you in terms of what industries do you think will be the most impacted, positive and negative post-COVID? And by extension, what technologies do you think are going to be the winning technologies coming out of this?
Well, first of all, tech impacted the most positively. Zoom is not the only option now, and it will not be the only option. And as we work to do more things using digital technology, I think there's a fairly big customer consensus from what can see that people do not want to shift everything to being remote or virtual all the time, but it helps some of the time. And I think it's going to help things like call centers because people don't like those impersonal voices on phones. So I think we're going to see a lot more tech with a visual dimension and have that as an option. I think the ones impacted the most, I mean, it's pretty obvious. It's anything involving travel and tourism, anything involving right now and for the short term. But it also, I would say, not so much by industry, but by the strength of a company. Like, I don't like to put particular companies on the spot, but I will say, having written about Boeing and their trouble with the 737 MAX 8, and even well before the crisis, I would say Boeing's in trouble. And that any company that had distinct weaknesses and a problem is not going to come out of this strong, even if they get a bailout, because they have so much to do, so much of a turnaround. So I would bet on companies that already had a really great culture. I think Procter & Gamble, for example, will do fine. They're making hand sanitizers. They already make soap. Boy, is there a demand for soap. And I think demand for soap is going to continue to be very strong. I think people are adopting new habits. So, but they also have a great sense of purpose and values. And so I think they will emerge strong. I think Ford, which seemed to have shifted to ventilators before General Motors, will probably emerge strong. So it's company by company. I've given you my sense of the key industries. Service industries will emerge fine. I'm talking about personal services, because people now see the necessity. And we have not yet, although tech is going to rush in and is going to still try to do robots and artificial intelligence, but we see the importance of those frontline workers. I think professional service companies will do just fine as long as they're keeping their customer contacts alive and are giving to customers rather than just taking from customers. So I think that must be the mode that PEO is in.
Great, thank you.
And I didn't ask you, is it Nick, where are you?
Well, I'm out in Mississauga, so just west of Toronto.
I see, I know these places. And you know what, I know some of you are not on video. I love seeing your faces. I feel it makes it warmer and more personal, like we're really having a conversation.
Oh, that's great. Rosabeth, let me ask you, you did winners and losers, but what's your perspective on the education as an industry? Even think about your school at Harvard. What's going to look differently in September?
Well, we are talking about that now. We don't know yet. We are working on two tracks, having classes on campus, but also given that we retooled very quickly over spring break to teach on Zoom. We're also training more people who would teach in the fall how to do it on Zoom. And we're asking for all the tips from the people who have been teaching, and they're all being shared with the people who might have to do it. So we're doing contingencies. The summer has been pretty much canceled. We're carrying out some things virtually, other things we're not trying to put them on the calendar right away. I've had many big conferences where I was a keynote speaker canceled, and they want to do the same conference program in October. And I say, that's silly. You can't roll out exactly the same thing. And we don't yet know where we'll be in October. Let's take it a step at a time. But for universities like Harvard, first of all, we were one of the first to go online, entirely online. In part, that was because we have incredible School of Public Health and medical centers and knew what was going on. In part, it was the decisiveness of our leaders and their trust that we could all do it. We had about 10 days to get ready, to have tutorials, to have classes, to get it done. And we'll be fine. We're tightening belts now. We are doing all the same things that companies should do. We're controlling expenses. Our fiscal year ends June 30th, and after that, salaries are frozen, hiring is frozen, except for things that are deemed essential. I'm worried in the education field, higher education, about all the smaller colleges and universities that were already already in weak financial shape. And like I said, I think the weak are going to have problems. I think what the weaker have to do is collaborate. It's hard for two weak to add up to a strong. Think about that in your mergers and acquisitions and alliances. But I do think the collaborations across higher education can help, including digital collaborations, going online. If you have a small school with a great Latin department and not much demand for Latin, why not offer it digitally and do it through somebody else? So we're going to see a greater mix, a greater variety in education. That's true for public schools through 12 schools too. And we need to innovate like crazy and be prepared for a future. I wouldn't say that's totally different. None of my colleagues at Harvard, we're doing okay on Zoom. None of us want that as a total substitute for our classroom, but we know it's in the future. So you have to be ready to add to the mix. I'm a great believer in addition, not subtraction.
No, that's great. Thank you for that. The similarities with the rest of the world and the businesses, it's almost the same in terms of what you guys are faced with as well. Kelly, we had another question from Teresa. I'll hand the mic to you.
Hello, it's Teresa here. I'm in Toronto. My question is around manufacturing, actually. You talked about being in fix-it mode. You've talked about some companies who may not make it through some of the challenges they had leading up to this. You know, I think the whole pandemic and politics in both the US and Canada have highlighted a gap in local manufacturing, dependence on countries like China or other markets that were hard hit at the onset. And so, you know, one of the challenges, though, of why we lost a lot of manufacturing is around productivity levels and cost. So we have this, you know, a deeper desire for what we want when we bring in business now around our values and our corporate cultures, our purpose. Can North America rationalize these if they really want to bring some level of manufacturing back locally based on what we've learned and still be competitive to have these companies to want to produce locally?
So I think that's an incredibly great question. Definitely looking for more local suppliers. And one thing we have to do is add a stakeholder orientation. Partly manufacturing shifted to China, but also Vietnam. I mean, I know a lot of companies are looking at Vietnam, which will not be a total solution, I will say, although a lot of energy and skill in Vietnam. But it was for cost reasons. It was to get it as cheaply as possible and even being willing to pay the extra transportation costs. So first of all, we have to not make cost the only consideration. It's a consideration, but we know that some things are going to pay more, and we know that consumers are often willing to pay more if they feel they share the values. And I'm not saying that made in Canada or made in America on a label is going to be enough. We've had made in America movements for, my gosh, at least almost 30 years, 20 years. I remember one in the early 90s, Ross Perot ran for president based on it. So, but it matters. It matters like green products. People will pay somewhat more for green products. I think companies have to think about not only the cost, but the message, and also find ways to bring in efficiencies. And so try to do the same things, but leaner. And I think if the workforce knows that's what you're trying to do and you're trying to save jobs, I think they'll cooperate. Even unions will cooperate. Unions understand that they need people employed locally. And there are many opportunities we often don't consider. In some sophisticated manufacturing, it's not always possible, but I've been struck by the number of people with 3D printers that at home are 3D printing components. There's a lot of things that we could be doing to distribute manufacturing a little more broadly. There are craftspeople who are making masks. You know, all those are forms of manufacturing. So the idea that when I say think outside the building as my title, think about it literally. Not all manufacturing has to be in one gigantic factory where everybody commutes at the same time and the parking lot gets filled up with cars and low air quality. We could, this is the time to think imaginatively, even about high volume manufacturing, what alternatives exist to distribute it. And we still will rely on China and Vietnam and Asia. And I know there will be other companies in other countries bidding for our business. And I don't think it's a good idea to say it's all local now and we close our borders. You know, that's giving up on the fact that it's a, it is a global world and people move from country to country. We need the expertise and the skill too. So I don't know exactly what kind of manufacturing you're thinking about. 3D printers might not work, but honestly, there are options that often involve tech that we could be exploring.
Thank you, Teresa, for that question. Rosabeth, we're coming close to the very end here, and we've had some great questions from the group. Is there, this is an open-ended question, really, is there anything that we really should walk away, any lessons learned that you can share with us that we haven't talked about but are really still very important, especially where we are today in this crisis, that you'd want to leave us with?
Well, so I've talked a lot, so I'm not sure I've left out too many things, and I appreciate everybody being patient. But, you know, I have a few mantras that matter to me, because I'm affected by this crisis too. One is, I have a whole chapter devoted to what I call Cantor's Law. Cantor's Law is that everything can look like a failure in the middle. Think about that. I named it after myself, by the way, because everybody should name a law after themselves. Called Cantor's Law. Everything can look like a failure in the middle. If you give up, by definition, it's a failure. If you are flexible and pivot, if you draw on your sense of purpose and meaning and ask what's really important, if you draw on your allies, which may be your coworkers, it might be your partners, then you can often get through it. And where there's life, there's hope. It's a failure in the middle, but this is just the middle. This is not the end of anything. You know, we say, well, it's the end of life as we know it. Well, maybe some parts of it, but we're always evolving and we're always changing. So don't give up.
That's great. I love, you opened on an optimistic note and you're closing us on such a great optimistic note as well. I love the optimism, which is this what we really need during these times. So thank you so much. That's going to conclude our session. Rosabeth, again, thank you so much for spending an hour with us, answering some of these questions for us, and really showing us a little bit of the way as we maneuver through this crisis and look to the future here on the race.
Len, thank you for your leadership at PEO. And to all of you who are being here, I've enjoyed the faces. I immediately wish we could have the little huddle after the meeting where I shake your hands and meet you personally, but here's the virtual handshake.
That's great. And maybe sometime in the near future, maybe it's the fall, maybe it's early 2021, we will meet you in the future and be able to shake your hand, give you a hug.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rosabeth. That concludes our session today. I want to thank you all for participating. And we look forward to seeing you at our next session, which will be, by the way, Friday, May 1st. It's a person that you all know very, very well, has been part of our organization for a long time at our conferences. Janice Stein will be talking with us and talking about the new world from a geopolitical perspective. So we hope to see you on May 1st. Otherwise, have a fantastic week. Stay positive and just keep driving through it. Talk to you later. All the best.